My name's Nora Desis, and I'm the Associate Dean for Translational Health Sciences at the University of Washington School of Medicine and a professor of medicine there.
So what does translational medicine mean?
Translational medicine means that it's really in basis discoveries to application. So if you're working on translational medicine, your goal is not just to delineate a mechanism or figure out how things work, but figure out how things work and make something that will work to improve human health.
So you are a cancer researcher, that's correct to call you a cancer researcher. So, and you work with vaccines. We know of vaccines as giving immunization against some sort of illness. How does that work for cancer?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I've been in this business for about 25 years, and if you've heard, like, the biggest breakthrough in cancer therapy is using the immune system nowadays. And when I first started, the major question was, can cancer even be recognized by the immune system? And so through all these years, we have figured out that cancer can be recognized by the immune system, and we've even identified proteins within the cancer that are being recognized. And so that understanding that we kind of know the antigens, those are immunogenic proteins, and we've figured out some of the reasons why, if cancer is being recognized by the immune system, why aren't people curing their own cancer? We've kind of figured out some of those mechanisms of how cancer evades the immune system. And now, putting both of those together, I think we're at the point where we've got these immune checkpoint inhibitor drugs, which are really changing the face of how we treat cancer patients today. Cancer vaccines are the next big thing coming up because we have all the pieces of the puzzle put together in terms of being able to develop vaccines that stimulate immune responses against these immunogenic proteins.
So we hear about all these different kinds of cancers, breast cancer, prostate cancer. Is it all the same mechanism? It just shows up in different parts of the body? Is that why we call it different things?
That's a terrific question. And I think these days, how we're even fundamentally talking about cancer is changing. There was a huge project a couple of decades ago called the Human Genome Project, where technology had advanced to the point where we could look at the DNA of every tumor, the DNA of every person. Now we have big databases available where we have the genome of 10,000 tumors. Now, being able to look at all those 10,000 tumors together, we're realizing some lung cancers look just like some breast cancers. Some ovarian cancers look just like melanoma from a genetic standpoint. There are drugs that are being developed in one disease that people are saying, wow, this gene mutation also happens here, and they're effective in another disease. So we're slowly moving away from talking about breast cancer, colon cancer, and now we're starting to talk about cancers based on the genes that are driving the disease. For example, there's a gene set in some cancers, it's called microsatellite instability. And it means that the DNA is so unstable, lots of mutations are created. That happens in melanoma, it happens in some endometrial cancers, it happens in some lung cancers, it happens in some breast cancers. There's a drug, immune checkpoint inhibitor, an immune drug, that seems to work really well in patients with colon cancer who have this microsatellite instability. Response rates in metastatic disease to this drug were 60%. That drug has been approved not for colon cancer, but for microsatellite unstable cancers, whatever that is, whatever your cancer is. And so this was really the first drug that's approved based on a genetic signature, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of that.
Okay, so that's interesting, because the reason I asked the question is we have a vaccine for the mumps, and we have a vaccine for the chicken pox.
Right.
If you have a vaccine for cancer, you have one vaccine for cancer, or do you have a whole bunch of vaccines that people would need to take in order to protect themselves from cancer?
You probably have one vaccine for many types of cancers. For example, I've been working for many years on kind of a vaccine that we've used as our workhorse vaccine to figure out how to immunize patients. And that vaccine was targeting a protein called HER2NU. And HER2NU is a protein that becomes overexpressed in about 30% of all breast cancers. And it's a driver protein, meaning that if you have a HER2NU positive breast cancer, you need HER2NU for that breast cancer to grow. But HER2NU is also upregulated in gastric cancer and some lung cancers and endometrial cancer. So this vaccine for HER2NU can be functional in any of those cancers. So as we talk about cancer more as a genetic disease and specific genes that are really driving that cancer, now we're creating multiple antigen vaccines that would really be focused on the genetic cause of cancer across many different types of cancers.
Some of the vaccines we know of use live or have in the past used live, maybe parts of the thing that you're trying to actually eliminate. Mm-hmm. Do you do that with cancer too? Can you use cancer cells as part of a vaccine for cancer?
Well, those were the earliest cancer vaccines. 100 years ago, that's what people did. And in the very early years of trying to develop cancer vaccines, people used irradiated tumors, they used chopped up tumors, they've used genetically modified tumors, and those just haven't been very effective at stimulating the immune response. One of the things we found out is that many of the proteins that kind of stimulate an immune response against cancer are seen by the immune system as self. We used to think that people didn't respond to their cancer from an immune standpoint because you had cancer and maybe your immune system's a bit messed up. But what we found now is that cancer patients, until they're very, very late stage, have completely functional immune systems. And the reason why they don't respond to cancer is that their normal mechanisms of preventing autoimmunity are preventing them from responding to cancer. So these immunogenic proteins in cancer are weird enough that the immune system makes a bit of a response, but they're self enough, like our self proteins, that the brakes come on that response. And the immune system gets signals, whoa, don't make an immune response to this, or we're going to have big problems in the body from autoimmunity. So if you give a whole tumor cell, that tumor cell gives the brake signal. What we found is if you can find small portions of those proteins called fragments, peptides, and you can pre-digest those proteins for the immune system, you can find those proteins, the fragments of these immunogenic proteins that will give a danger signal. So we can't give whole tumors or tumor lysates or undigested proteins to the immune system. We have to use methodologies to find those small fragments within these self-proteins that the immune system has never seen before. And when you give those in a vaccine, the immune system says, oh, this is dangerous.
Hmm. So you're working on several different cancer vaccines. Is that? Can
yes.
you tell me a little bit about the range of what you're working on?
Yes, we're looking at a range of tumors, and we're looking at a range of stages of the tumor. So most of our work has really been in therapeutic vaccines. Now, when you think about vaccines in general, and you brought up infectious disease vaccines, infectious disease vaccines have been the biggest breakthrough in the history of medicine. Most of the things we used to die from are eradicated off the face of the earth, or we have 1% of people compared to nearly 100% of people developing these diseases. But those vaccines are given prior to getting the infection. There are very few infectious disease vaccines that we give after you have the infection, like rabies, right? Because you just want to try to get an immune system to get rid of rabies because it's so lethal. So therapeutic vaccines is a very hard road to hoe, but that's the road that we've been in with cancer, because we're immunizing against these self-antigens. And regulatory agencies rightly are concerned that maybe you're going to be generating autoimmune disease. And when you think about it, the reason why infectious disease vaccines work so well is because they are dangerous. The immune system is already primed to say this is foreign. So we've been looking at patients who have cancer who are at a high risk of relapse but have been treated to complete response. But we know because of their high risk of relapse that they probably have cancer somewhere in their body we just can't see. And initially, that was the closest we could get to immunizing to protect against cancer. What we found is, using HER2-new, that we have been able to push relapse out or even prevent relapse in some patients. So now that has spurred us on to develop multiple antigen vaccines on the launch pad for colon cancer, for ovarian cancer. We have a phase 2 study going on in ovarian cancer where we're trying to prove the point with a vaccine that we can prevent disease relapse, and in lung cancer. So we're really going down that pathway of therapeutic vaccines. But those early data have made us think, well, maybe we could prevent cancer. And how would you do that? What would you immunize against? Well, with all this understanding of the human genome, and then basic biologists going back and asking those mechanistic questions that aren't translational medicine, those of us who do translational medicine have access to that data, and we've begun to identify self-proteins that become aberrantly or weirdly expressed in, let's say, a colon adenoma. So you go get your colonoscopy. The doctor said, you have an adenoma. Now you have to get a colonoscopy every 6 months because that predisposes you to the development of colon cancer. We found genes that are upregulated in those adenomas that are conserved upregulation into cancer. And we've created a vaccine that targets those proteins. And when we take mice that are genetically engineered to develop adenomas that progress to carcinomas, using that vaccine, we can prevent the development of adenomas in about 50% of mice. So this kind of opens the door to the development of preventative vaccines. And we have projects for those ongoing in breast cancer, colon cancer, and prostate cancer.
So are you testing vaccines in patients yet?
We are. We have vaccines for breast and ovarian cancer in patients. Two of the vaccines that we have in breast cancer, their multiple antigen vaccines, are in earlier stage patients that are high risk trying to prevent relapse. But the other vaccine that we have is targeting proteins involved in the cancer stem cell. These are cells in breast cancer that really are the ones that are not killed by chemotherapy or radiation therapy. And in some patients, there's enough of them that they're the reason for recurrence. And we're hoping that that's the type of vaccine we could give to women who are at genetically high risk for the development of breast cancer that maybe will prevent them from getting breast cancer.
So you would do that on a preventive basis, right? Whereas many women right now are having their breasts removed if they have that genetic marker in them. So that would be, I would say that a lot of women would say a vaccine would be preferable to something like that.
Yeah, and it's a long road to haul to see. Right now we're in phase 1 studies with that vaccine. It looks really good. No one's had bad side effects to it. And the big thing with preventative vaccines is, how do you get those into the clinic and into practice, not in 25 or 30 years, you know, because the clinical trials take large numbers of patients, and you have to follow them to see whether the vaccine makes a difference. So the translational part of it is, the laboratory aspects, because of all the new technology, have become relatively easy. And with computer modeling and genomics and collaborations with people who can handle this type of big data, we can come up with vaccines and have them tested in animals and be ready to go to the FDA in a couple of years. But now the creativity part of it is figuring out what are the right patient populations to go into to get an early signal that there will be clinical efficacy. And most importantly, is there a marker that we can measure in the blood that would be indicative that patients will have that clinically effective response? Because that's really what's brought infectious disease vaccines forward so quickly. They can give an infectious disease vaccine and measure a titer, and they know that titer correlates with protection. And that's where we are right now with cancer vaccines, trying to figure out what is the marker that correlates with protection that would allow us to rapidly bring these vaccines into clinic.
Okay, so we'll finish with this. You made reference to those infectious disease vaccines. What are the right expectations to have? Because now that those vaccines have been so effective, can you expect to have the same results with a cancer vaccine?
I think where cancer vaccines are right now, state of the art, and there's only one approved cancer vaccine, therapeutic vaccine for prostate cancer called Provenge, that's given to those people, that sweet spot I told you of patients who have very minimal disease. I believe that we will see many therapeutic vaccines approved within the next 5 to 8 years. And they're going to be approved in combination with these immune checkpoint inhibitor drugs because, especially for therapeutic vaccines, we know now these immune checkpoint proteins that prevent T cells from responding to the tumor are probably a major mechanism by which the tumor escapes the immune system. So if you have a patient who doesn't have many T cells, if you can give them T cells that will traffic to the tumor, it's a marriage made in heaven with these immune checkpoint inhibitors. Preventative vaccines, I think that's a longer road. We're just at the beginning of finally having the tools and the understanding to be able to identify the multiple important biologic pathways for a cancer. The fact that we're in phase one clinical trials right now, as are other people, even advancing to phase two clinical trials, is super encouraging because if you look at the track record of therapeutic vaccines within a 5-year period of time, we would never have been in clinical trials with these. So I think that the preventative vaccines will come quicker, much quicker than the big long road we've had with the therapeutic vaccines. But I can't imagine one being approved within the next decade. I think that that's a little bit more longer viewpoint, but hopefully within my lifetime.
Okay, is there anything I didn't ask you, Dr. Desis, that you wanted to say?
I think for cancer patients, you know, I have to say I've been in this field for a long time, and for many, many years, probably the first 15 years that I was an oncologist, we treated cancer the exact same way as I remember some of my next-door neighbors being treated when I was a kid. Now, in the last 10 years, it's a totally different world, and patients are living longer with their disease. And these new immune drugs, they're approved by the FDA in about 5 different cancers, but we're really learning quickly how to make cancers that don't respond to these drugs right now be responsive to these drugs. So it is really a whole new world with cancer therapy, with therapies that are not the old chemotherapies that used to poison people. And I think that cancer patients should just have a tremendous amount of hope over the horizon. I mean, leaving you with the story of Jimmy Carter, who had melanoma, 92 years old, liver and metastatic lesion to the head, received one of these immune checkpoint inhibitors, and he's been disease-free for quite some time now. So it's a whole new world for cancer therapy, and it's a wonderful time and a very happy time to be an oncologist right now.